the knowledge or understanding that the things that come out of their mouth reflects what the gift is, or what the gift most certainly is not. I'd mentioned, or I'm going to pick up a couple of things that I started but I didn't tell you about or didn't finish telling you about, just so you'll recognize them. Remember me telling you that Matthew was a giver, and then I just sort of dropped it there and forgot to tell you the rest of it? Here's how you can know that Matthew is a giver, by the things that he writes about. And when you start comparing what he writes about that the other people left out, then is when it becomes real apparent. We talked about Matthew being a tax collector, of course, which gives you the first clue that money was important to him. He's the only one that talks about not letting the left hand know what the right hand is doing, that secretiveness that deals with giving. As you go through his parables, he spends a lot of time talking about poor stewardship. Many of the parables that he gives has something to say or something to do with stewardship. Matthew's the only one that goes into detail and tells us about the gifts of the wise men. It's not that these other people, Luke most certainly would have known it, but it's that Matthew, because of his intense desire in picking up on the material things, he emphasizes for us the gifts of the wise men. He's the one that talks about the 30 pieces of silver. Is that me? He's the one that talks about the 30 pieces of silver. And so as you go through the book, if you were to take a pen or a colored thing of some kind, and as you went through and you just underlined everything that talked about money or material possessions, you'd be amazed. It just crops up all over the book. Now, if you were to look at the problems or look at Luke, we talked about Luke being a teacher, right? Well, if you go through the characteristics that's listed here for teacher, and you just start underlining in the book of Luke, in the Luke Acts for that matter, and just underlining these things in the book, you'll be amazed at how those teacher qualities just crop in and come out in the things that he tells that Jesus did, or the places that Jesus goes, or he gives this chronological order to all of these things. It just comes out in the book. Okay, the other thing that I brought up but didn't finish was the ant story. That illustrates a couple of things. First, in the Lord, in getting my attention about the gifts, seems that every time I turn around, I experience something, and he says, this relates to the gifts. Do you see it? After a while, I'm starting to see it more and more, and I'm hoping that's something that you asked the Lord to do for you. But back to the ants. What happened? Well, several years ago, in office where I work, in my office, I have a computer. And, of course, I like my computer as much as any giver would. And I'm not a giver, but I love my computer. Well, it just so happens that ants like computers, too. In fact, ants love to eat, for some reason, the electrical boards in them. Well, these ants were just swarming all over my computer and just eating it alive, so to say. And so I got upset about it, and I picked up the phone and called the manager and said, look, I've got ants all over my office. You need to send somebody out here and kill them. All of them. I don't want any of them around. Kill them all. So, an hour later, there was a knock on the door, and the man with a hat and the spray, and he walks in and says, oh, you got an ant problem. I said, yeah, look at that computer over there. There's ants all over it. Of course I've got a problem. That's why I called. I was really irritated by that time. And so he walks in, looks around, takes his little spray and goes over there in the corner and sprays here and sprays over here, and then he sprays over here. Then he turns around and starts to walk out the door. So where are you going, guy? Can't you see that thing? The ant's all over it. He just looked at me. They'll die. Die, bull. I want you to kill them. I don't want to wait for them to die. He said, look, what I did is I went around and sprayed the ant trails. Within a few hours, those ants won't be able to get home and they'll just die. And so he left, and several hours later, the ants were dying and they were gone out of my computer, and I was sitting there thinking about that. And the Lord brought to my mind the server. And he revealed to me that this is how the server is when it comes to praise. They have to have the praise because it gives them a direction in life. You take the praise away and they don't know what they're doing, whether what they're doing is right or wrong, good or bad, helpful or non-helpful. And so the ants, much like the server, and by the way, the book of Proverbs talks about ants in the terms of servers, don't they? Remember how hard they work? Well, that sounds like a server to me. Okay, the ant is a real good parallel in that respect. They need the praise. They need to know that what they're doing is doing something that's beneficial to the person that they're serving. And if you don't give that to them on a daily basis, you rob them of that joy. They need it. You need to give it. Okay, that was the ant story. Let me pick up a few questions about that. Everybody know about ants? Well, let me pick up a few other things that I've left out, and then we will go somewhere else. The teachers. One other characteristic that's very important about teachers is truth is supreme with a teacher. They hate liars. You want to get on the bad side of a teacher, all you have to do is lie. They catch you, that's it. They won't have anything else to do. They hate liars. Remember when Jesus was standing before Pilate and they had this little conversation about truth? And the flippant Pilate responds, "What is truth?" He could care less. Well, he was telling you that one, if nothing else, he's not a teacher, because a teacher would never treat truth in that manner. For the teacher, truth is supreme. And if you listen to a teacher's language, frequently all sorts of references to truth and honesty will creep up. You just hear it coming out of their mouths automatically. With the prophet, the key word is sincerity. They hate hypocrisy, and that's why they become the best hypocrite or the worst hypocrites in the world, is when they travel away from God and they lose that sincerity. They get very hypocritical. That's the worst that a prophet can be, is hypocritical. Well, no, that's the worst they can be. What's the worst that a mercy can be? Immoral. Okay, we'll come back to that in a minute. Mercies, on the other hand, one of the things that comes out in their language is genuineness. They want to know that the person and the experiences that they're working with are genuine to the person. And they can sense it when you're not being... And genuineness is a little bit different than truth. When a teacher talks about truth, they're really talking about factual truth. But when a mercy talks about being genuine, it's not just the honesty, it's the relevance. It's how they feel about everything. And so it's a feeling type of something that takes place at a feeling level, whereas with a teacher it takes place at a very factual level. See the difference? Same concept of honesty and truthfulness, but it's presented in two completely different manner, two different ways. Two others, and then we will go to the other information that I have to present. The organizer, the key word for the organizer is loyalty. One of the things that the organizer does is they continually test the people around them for dependability and loyalty. Several years ago, as I was working on the organizer, I didn't have a lot of understanding or concept of why they felt what they did or what they experienced or why they acted in the manner that they did. In fact, at times I'd wondered why they were so harsh. I mean, they'd come into my office to be counseled, and everything that would come out of their mouth dealt with either loyalty or she's undependable or he's undependable or disloyal. And I would look at the situation they were talking about. It seemed to me that it had nothing to do with loyalty or trustworthiness. But with this person, it was everything. It was the whole world. And so I was asking the Lord about, what's the big deal about loyalty? Loyalty with these people. And the Lord had me do a little study. And when I finished that study on loyalty, I was amazed at what I'd found. If you go through the Bible and you look for examples of loyalty or disloyalty, One of the things that you will find that there are 40 major examples of betrayal or disloyalty in God's Word. I mean, we're talking about people events, the real thing, where people are disloyal or undependable. And in 98% of those cases, death was the consequence to somebody. Jesus died. He was betrayed. You go back to the Old Testament and Ahithophel. He betrayed David, the king. What did he do? Well, he went and hanged himself. But those are just two examples. You go through and you start looking. And over again, disloyalty results in death. And then all of a sudden, I could understand why loyalty was so important to the organizer. They instinctively know that if a person is disloyal to them, if they're untrustworthy, that will totally undermine the work that they're doing. I've referred several times to Nehemiah. And in that book, there's two things that Nehemiah really emphasizes. He has his enemies that are continually trying to undermine him, and he's trying to destroy his work. And in one instance, these enemies come, and they're trying to frighten Nehemiah away from the work because they don't want those walls built. The walls of Jerusalem, they didn't want those rebuilt. And so they try and scare Nehemiah, and they tell him that his enemies are plotting to kill him, and they say to him, you know, a safe place to hide is in the temple. And he immediately recognized what they were doing and told him, that's nonsense. With God on my side, I need not be afraid of anything. I fear God. I don't fear man. And he had sense enough to know that once you trusted in the Lord don't let you down. People can. Sometimes accidentally, sometimes on purpose, but God never does. And that's where our real sense of loyalty belongs, is with God. And it works. And he cares for us. What's the key word for an exhorter? Wisdom. They esteem wisdom. If you have your Bibles, turn to Proverbs chapter 2. My child, if you receive my words and you treasure up my commandments with you, making your ear attentive to wisdom and inclining your heart to understanding. Yes, if you cry out for insight and raise your voice for understanding, if you seek it like silver, and search for it as for a hidden treasure. One of the things that the pastor here is trying to get you to see the importance of is the education. Not a piece of paper that says you have an education, but the real education where you delve in, you search out, and you come up with these nuggets that are of tremendous value. If you search for it as for a hidden treasure, then you'll understand the fear of God and find the knowledge of God. And those are the kinds of things that the exhorter really enjoys, wisdom. And so the book of Proverbs is very important for those who seek after wisdom, particularly the exhorters. Okay, let's see if we can put to a practical use some of the things that we've talked about. To do that, I need to share some things about myself that will help you understand where I'm coming from and what some of the things or some of the experiences that God has brought to my life that brings me to the point in life where I see things or try to see things from God's point of view, which is wisdom. That is wisdom, by the way. Wisdom, a definition of wisdom, is seeing things from God's perspective, from God's point of view. And it seems like over the last 10, 12, 13 years, one event or circumstance in my life after another, God has brought out or teaches me things about the motivational gifts that became very practical things in understanding and working with other people. Okay. Obviously, by now, you know I'm a family counselor and have been for 20 years or so. And obviously, these people come in, sit down, and talk about their problems. Now, obviously, there's different ways that a person can approach those problems. Some people, some counselors will sit there and quietly listen. Yes, tell me more, you know, that kind of thing. Very passive counselor. I'm not a passive counselor. Not passive at all. In fact, is I would go to the other extreme. But one life's experiences comes from sitting down and hearing about it. Two other life's experiences, one comes from working in a mental hospital for 13 years with drunks and drug abusers and seeing the things that these people did not only to their lives, but how they would utterly destroy their own families with their addiction and their abuse of other people. And the things that the Lord brought to my understanding about, one, how you work with a person who's doing that, but more importantly, how you work with a family that's having or that's tolerating that, and the things that you can specifically do once you understand their gift. The third part of the understanding or teaching that I rely on is that part that I have acquired from working as a police officer for 20 years. And let me tell you, that is the real life. I suppose if you want to see where the real problems of life is, you really are confronted with having to deal with serious crises immediately it comes on the streets of the country that we live in. So I'm going to share some of those experiences and some of the things from these three areas of life that try and point out how you can take the motivational gifts off of a piece of paper, out of a book, how you can take those and translate those into an everyday life situations where you can help your family or other families in a peaceful counseling situation or on the street in a severe crisis situation or in a home where people are throwing pots and pans at each other and running at each other with knives. Is that okay with you? Is there anybody that objects? Are there any mercies that object? Yeah, this is the part the mercies don't like. But there is a part that mercies play in it. Several years ago, on a late March night, my partner and I had made a call to an upstairs apartment. We'd received a call that there was a disturbance going on, and so we walked up this narrow, dark stairways and pounded on the door, and this young man comes to the door, and this is where observation comes in. Of course, now the Lord's trying to teach me, not only am I looking for the superficial facts, He's already trying to key me into looking for their motivational gift, because once you do that, you've learned something that's very powerful and useful in dealing with that person. Well, this young guy comes to the door, we knock on the door, he comes to the door, and he is covered in sweat. I mean, you'd swear he just got out of a swimming pool and didn't bother to dry off. He is totally covered with sweat. Now, I mean, it's 10 degrees outside, and he comes to the door like this, and I said, "What's wrong? I mean, I just got out of the shower." "Sure, you just got out of the shower. That's not what's going on here?" And we say, "We've got a call that there was a disturbance going on here at the house. What's going on?" "There's no disturbance." Truthfulness. "There's no disturbance here. Nothing at all." "Well, can we step in and get out of the cold and get out of the hallway so all your friends and neighbors and enemies don't hear what's going on?" "Well, no, but, well, I guess so. I'm getting cold now." So we step in the door, and my partner starts to talk to him. One of the things I notice as I step in the door that there's a garbage can at my feet, and it's dark. The apartment's dark. We step in. It's dark. I look down. There's a garbage can with a bunch of glass in it. I said, "What's all this glass?" He said, "Oh, I broke a Coke bottle." "Sure, you broke a Coke bottle." So I tell my partner, "I'll go look around, and you talk to him." So I start walking back, go through the living room. Everything is neat and clean and in perfect order. Must have been a server that kept that house. So look on my right. Everything's nice and clean. I walk down this narrow hallway. Start on one side and come back together. Look at a bedroom. Everything's nice and neat and clean. Next bedroom, two kids in bed asleep. And things are on the wall. Everything's perfect. Walk into the next bedroom, the third bedroom, and the woman's purse is on the bed. Now, where does a woman go without a purse? So I said, "Woman's purse is on the bed." And so again, the bed's made, too. So I walk out. So they hadn't been to bed yet. So I walk out, and it's 11 o'clock at night. So I walk out, go to the bathroom, and there's blood all over the sink and some glass. I guess this is where the Coke bottle incident happened. So I come back to the guy and said, where'd the blood come from in the bathroom? He said, I cut my finger. Okay, so then I turn around and walk into the kitchen and turn on the light. And there is blood and glass everywhere. There's blood, glass, and hair everywhere. On the walls, on the refrigerator. You look at the refrigerator and there's just streaks of blood everywhere. This is the type of apartment that had a door going downstairs and the back door. Open the back door and there's glass and blood all the way down the stairways. And I come in and say, partner, you need to go look at the kitchen. And by the way, there was also a garbage can sitting there filled with glass and blood and an iron. So I know where the hair came from. So I came back and talked to the guy and started to say something to him. And the Lord clued me in that the guy was a mercy. Mercies, you know, well, they make mistakes sometimes too. And so I said, you know, it's obvious that you've done something to your wife or girlfriend. Which is it? She said, my wife. Where's she at? Well, she's not here. She went to see a friend. I said, yeah, she went to see a friend. Well, we can see what's happened here. And the thing is, she may still be alive. If you tell us where she's at, maybe we can get to her and help her. He was a mercy. He didn't want her suffering. Beat her up with an iron, but he didn't want her suffering. I know that's inconsistent, but... And so, when asking that question, I looked in his eyes. You could see that he was mercy, how he talked. He talked slow and softly. He was a mercy. And he bent his head and started crying and said, she's in the alley two blocks down, sitting in a car. I think she's dead. We went down there, found her, and in fact, she got her to a hospital and she survived. But the thing was, if it had been a prophet or had been a teacher standing there and saying to him, you know, she may still be alive. Why don't you tell us what's going on? Things really get out of, we understand how things can really get hard for you at times. I mean, communicating as if he had feelings. If he had been a teacher, it wouldn't have been a thing, would it? Well, the Lord caused me to see after that event, after going through that event, that how you approach people, if you know what their gifts is, if you can key in on that as quickly as possible, then you can save lives or you can save yourself a whole lot of trouble and embarrassment. Starting to see. Okay, walk into a house and people are screaming and fighting at each other. That doesn't happen around here, does it? I mean, I bet your neighbors do it. 3 o'clock in the morning, you hear glass breaking, people screaming, and you wonder what's going on, and you turn over and you go back to sleep, right? And you wonder what you should or shouldn't do about it. Is there something to do about it? One of the things that the church can do is have a powerful intervening force in the community. Now, I told you that we were going to talk a little bit about what the church can do as far as how the gifts help. What the church can do, a churches establish a reputation in their communities. They're either known as rich congregations filled with people who have no concern or desire for other people, and they build bigger churches and bigger gymnasiums and all these other things, or it has a reputation as a church that does nothing. Everybody comes to church and goes to sleep and then goes home and goes to sleep. Or there's other congregations where people come, they praise God, and then they leave and they take God out into their communities with them. It's my sensation about this particular congregation that's one of the things that you do. So how can the gifts help in that kind of ministry? Well, again, you establish a reputation. If people in the community start to realize that you have a genuine concern for them, they have problems, they come, you sit down and patiently listen to those problems, and then you go get a prophet or you go get an exhorter to deal with that person or their problems, after a while the reputation gets around that you are a group of people that not only talk about good works or talk about faith, you're a people who do things that are faithful. And that's how you acquire that reputation. One of the things I would strongly urge you to do, or the ministers here to consider doing, is establishing what you could call, you can call it anything you want to, but let's just give it a name right now, an alert team. And that alert team be made up of seven people. Why seven? Seven gifts, right? That's what you said, seven gifts. Why one from each of the gifts? Because each of those people have a different perspective. They walk into a house, they walk into a problem, they walk into a crisis. If it's a server, they see physical things. If it's a mercy, they see emotional things. The server's not going to see anything emotional. They're going to see everything in a physical blend. And so you have these seven people who are on this team. Each one who is practicing their gift, who is working in their gift, who's trying to emphasize that gift. And so this alert team is on call. And what happens is somebody's having problems with their husband or with their family or a crisis develops. And the first thing they know to do is they call the pastor. Look, I'm having problems. The pastor looks at the alert team that's up. They come and give them a call and say, so-and-so over here down the block just called and they have a crisis going on in their family. Get your team together. So all seven of you go marching into their, well, you knock on the door and ask that they can come in. They say, yeah, they know why you're there by now because of your reputation. You knock on the door, all seven of you are there, and the seven of you are looking and doing seven different things, getting seven different perceptives about what's going on. Those perceptions that you're gaining and acquiring give you ideas about solutions, short-term solutions and long-term solutions to the problem that's going on. And so the first thing you do is you have the exhorter step forward and say, because they're the most apt as far as crisis intervention, and say, you gave us a call, give me an idea of what the problem is. And while the person's talking, the exhorter is evaluating the circumstances. He's evaluating, or she's evaluating, because there's no sexual difference. Girl, man or woman, either one can be the exhorter. Anyone can be the prophet. Anyone can be, and he's evaluating what it takes to immediately defuse the situation. So they defuse the situation. And so you all leave and leave it hanging like. No, you'll get a call 2 days later and say, we've got another crisis. So you don't do that. That's why you got seven people with you. And you say, okay, we've defused this particular situation. So what are we going to do about this evening? What are we going to do about tomorrow? What are we going to do about next week? Well, you have an organizer there, don't you? And that organizer is starting to already formulate a plan about what they're seeing that's disorganized or what needs to be organized. And so you all go back to the current church and you sit down and talk about it. And the server says, there's a lot of physical things that's going on here, that if these things are changed or altered or we can make some interventions in this way, it will probably release some pressure over here. And the prophet says, yeah, I noticed something over there. They had a stack of Playboys over there in the corner. And so that information comes out and says, okay, that's something that we need to deal with, that kind of stuff that's going on. And the mercy says, I really sense this woman was terrorized by her husband. And so we need to look into that, how we can relieve or help her with some of those feelings, or if it need be, give her a safe atmosphere to be in while we deal with some of the other problems that's going on. And so you just go down the line, all seven giving the input. What input does the giver have? Well, maybe money can help in some of the situation. Maybe it can. They're there to make the assessment. Would money be of value or usefulness? Or is there some type of materialistic thing that would help relieve some of the tension that's going on here? The server may see physical things that could be done. And so they may come on a regular basis for a while to help the woman in getting out of the depression, to clean up the house so that she feels better. You see how you put the seven together. And if you've done that for a while, can you imagine what happens with the people in the community who's invited you into their homes? And when you've come, you have resolved their problems. The immediate crisis, you settled in such a way that you didn't have to call the police and have all these sirens and ambulances and fire trucks surrounding the neighborhood's house trying to get things done, when it's just this time seven ordinary people who are Christians depending on God's will. And the reputation that you have for these teams get around. And the reputation is, even with non-Christians, you know, you're having a problem, give the pastor a call. He'll send a team out, and it won't end in a great big explosion with blood and guts everywhere flowing down the walls. Do you see? That's how you establish your reputation, your ministry, and you're dealing with people with the kinds of severe problems that they have in life. So what happens a year later? This family that you started with, that you worked with over a period of several months, they start coming to church, not because you tell them you need to, but because they see you in the example that you presented. And so there goes an emergency right there. And it just stopped. And it was a squad car. You can always tell the difference between... No, you don't want to hear that. They say in combat that you can tell the difference in who's the good guys and who the bad guys because of the caliber weapon that's being fired and the sound of the weapon. And it's sort of like it goes with sirens. I can tell the difference between a siren, whether it's a fire truck, ambulance, or a squad car. What was I saying before I got off the topic? Do you understand how these teams could be formed and work? Well, there goes another one. I guess it just escalated. Let me give you a story about escalation. Do you want to hear another story? Okay. I've been working in South Dallas, probably 4 or 5 years, when one Saturday afternoon, I normally work on the weekends because that's when the busiest and that's when most of the nice things or terrible things are going on. We just got in a squad car. It's 3:30 in the afternoon, hot, July, hot, terribly hot. We just got in a squad car. Remind me to tell you what Mexican food has to do with this. We just got in the squad car, and we just left the station, and the dispatcher, we were element 311, that was our particular car number, and said, 311, we got a disturbance over here, and then they gave us an address on Valentine Street, 2700 Valentine Street. I picked up the radio and said, en route, you know, no big deal, it's just a typical Saturday night. We'd gone about a block and a half, and the dispatcher comes on again and says, 311, we're sending you a cover element to go with you. It seems like whatever's going on is escalating, and so we got a cover that's going with you to back you up. I said, yeah, well, okay. We're still en route. Go a couple more blocks, and the emergency signal goes off. Now, I don't know if any of you watch Cops, but every once in the background you hear that beep, 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 and you know that emergency's happened. And your adrenaline starts to flow, and it goes beep, 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 and it says 311, you're now code 3 on a shooting. Okay, we're code 3 on a shooting. Things are really getting hot tonight. And so hang it up, go another block or two, and by this time we're code 3, or you're going with lights and siren, and then the emergency signal goes off again. Oh, no. What have we stepped into this time? Beep, 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 311. We're signing 341, 343, and 342 as backups. There's people there with automatic weapons, and there's a gang fight going on. Gee whiz, that was going to be a real night. I don't think I would send an alert team into that. When we got to the place, fortunately, that particular time, am I speaking too close to this thing? Is that what it is? Just about. Okay. When we got to the place, the shooter had just left. And we drove up, and there was bodies everywhere. As we walked to the backyard, I saw a few bodies that I didn't expect to see. There was evidently there was a... We got to the backyard, and there were several bodies laying all around. People had been shot. And so by that time, the ambulances got there, and they'd taken care of them, or were starting to take care of them, and hauling off to the hospital, and some of the witnesses to the police department, and we got information about what had taken place. Nothing in that about motivational gifts, right? Okay. A couple of weeks later, I had to skip a week for some reason, and a couple of weeks later, I came back to work on a Saturday night, and I walked in and went back to the board, and there was pictures of people who were wanted. And I noticed that one of the pictures of the person who was wanted was a guy who had been involved in this shooting. He was from Mexico. And they said he was still in the area, and they gave a description of the car and the license plate and description of him. And while I was standing there looking at it, I gave a silent prayer. I said, "Lord, this person has really disturbed the community and what's going on with the community. He's killed several people. He's caused considerable distress to many families. Lord, if it's your will, if you would put this person in my hands, I'd sure appreciate it." So we went out, got in a car, drove away from the police station, and I'm going down the street, and I look up, and here comes this 1987 Cutlass Supreme with a license number that I just read off that board. And I said, "Thank you, Lord. Thank you." Yeah, we got him out of the car, we arrested him, we took him to jail. But it really felt good. When you depend on the Lord, it's just amazing the kinds of things that he'll do for you. It's not that he does that every time. I've been in a lot of situations where there was nothing happening, but it's that the person who decides they're going to serve God, regardless of the situations, the Lord has you on call. And when he has you on call, you're there to be used when he needs you. Okay, let me stop a second. Questions you'd like to ask? Comments you'd like to make? Stones that you'd like to throw? Yes. About the Mexican food. One of the things that I tend to do is look for stolen cars, because obviously they're easier to find. For some people, you can't find them at all, but for me, they're easy to find. And invariably, when we've eaten Mexican food, I find a stolen car. And I guess that happened 12, 13 times in a row. And so usually if I want some excitement for a particular night, I would say to my partner, who was used to it by now, "Let's go eat Mexican food." And he knew what that meant. I guess I've probably been in 70 or 80 high-speed chases. And when you see it on TV, it's just not the same thing it is in real life. When you're going around those corners 80, 90 miles an hour and these people shooting at you, it isn't like it is on TV, I promise you. So that's where the Mexican food came in. It's a real help sometimes if you need some excitement in your life. Other more appropriate questions.
Brother, is there a time when, let me see if I can phrase this question right, when the usage of the gifts or of your gift in life takes you out from under authority, out of God's chain of authority? For instance, I guess there'd be a lot of examples. Probably one more to mind right now would be the husband and wife situation. Is there ever a time when it pulls you out from under that chain of authority?
That's a very complex question, and it's going to take me a few minutes to answer it.
I'm a teacher. That's part of it.
It's extremely important. First of all, just being a police officer, the Lord has taught me a lot about authority. When you turn to Romans 13, and it talks about God has established authority. God established it. It is one of the universal gifts that God has given mankind is authority. And you start to realize just how important that is. You put a gun on, you're carrying it around, that gun represents a type of authority. You can misuse it, you can abuse it, or it is there to represent God's authority. And that's exactly how I perceive it. It represents not me. I'm a representative of God. I'm a minister of God when I put that on. But The other side, and the question that you're asking is, what about in the counseling office? What authority do you have? I've asked the Lord that question many times and talked to him at great length about that, because sometimes two people will come in and the problem is the husband and their problems with authority, and they lord over and they say, everybody, you can't breathe unless I tell you to breathe. And they're sitting there, and one of the things that's important to do as a counselor, very important to do as a counselor, is you talk to the person in authority. You ask them, what brings you here? And of course, they start telling all the problems. My wife doesn't do what I tell her to do. My kids don't do what they tell them to do. That my house is just a total wreck. And I'm here for you to cure or solve the problem. Oh, that's great. And you're really wanting me to do that? Yes. Then one thing I need from you to do that. And let me tell you up front that it's irrevocable. I need the authority, your authority, to do that. Do you see the trap? I need your authority to do that. But before you give me the authority, you need to understand, you give me the authority, you invest in me, your authority, to help you solve the problems in your family. That means you're putting yourself under me. Now let me tell you about being under me. I listen to God. If I tell you anything or give you anything to do that doesn't come out of God's will or out of God's, basically God's principle, if I can't point to a scripture that says, do this, you don't have to do it. But if I point to a scripture and say, this is what it says, and it convicts you, you have to do it. Or if you can't do it, at least you need to recognize that you ought to do it. And that's how the authority is going to work. If they say, I can't do that, and I said, there's the door. So you obtain their authority first. That's for that situation. But what happens when a woman comes in, she has this kind of husband who is not a Christian and who is having all of these terrific problems. Perhaps their husband's an alcoholic. Perhaps they're beating them. Let's take that one, because that's a very real one in our society, isn't it? Every time they turn around, every Saturday night, their husband comes in drunk and they're beating him. And she's sitting down and she's saying to you, this is what my husband is doing. The husband hasn't given me the authority. In fact, if the husband knew the wife was there, he'd go after her with a shotgun. So you don't have his authority. That's the question you're posing, right? That you'd say that would be the ultimate as far as that problem, right?
Okay.
You want to say something else about that?
Yeah, basically, what I'm like in the Christian setting, in the Christian home, where both people are Christians, both of them have good gifts, and they want to exercise their gifts.
Okay, let me take the first one first, and then I'll come back and say you got two Christians. Okay, take the first one first. The situation is you have this alcoholic who's beating his wife, who Christian or non-Christian, doesn't make any difference. What do you tell the woman? First thing I do is explain to her that God has created authority in our lives and that we must be under that authority, because the purpose of authority is to protect and serve. Those are the two things that authority is to do. It's not to drag around, beat over the head. It's not to make you do or conform to their will. The purpose of authority is to protect and serve. Now, what you're telling me is, and giving where I live, and it just so happens that I live in the state of Texas. And the state of Texas has certain laws against spousal abuse. And so I'm immediately placing myself under a law, under authority. And I say to the woman, ma'am, the law says that whenever your husband strikes you, you're to go over to the telephone or your next door neighbor's telephone, you dial 911, and report it. She shakes her head. I'm not about to do that. One, he might kill me. And two, I don't want him to go to jail. And so what I say to her when she says that is, you are resisting the authority of God. God has created the authority of the state that you live under. And under that authority, it tells you what you're supposed to do. As long as you do what that authority tells you to do, God can protect you. Whenever you say, I'm not going to do it, then you have slapped God in the face and you shut the door to any kind of protection that God can afford you. So by this time, you've done one of two things. The woman says, I'm ready to leave because I don't want to be under God's authority. Or, yes, I'll be under God's authority no matter how difficult it is. I'm a Christian. I want to do things God's way. Then the first thing you do, and you give him thing, one thing at a time to do, you wait for him to strike you. You make absolutely sure you don't provoke it the first time. Thereafter, I want you to provoke it. But the first time, that's because I'm a sort of a crazy counselor. The first time, you don't provoke it. And as soon as he strikes you, go call 911. He goes off to jail, and you better not bail him out. And when the squad car gets there, you better not fight with the police because they're hauling him off to jail, because it's in jail that he's going to learn that he doesn't want to be back. He doesn't want to be there. And that's how he learns the lesson, the consequences. He don't want to be in jail. He may forget that for a while or after several months and do it again, and you do the same thing again. You dial the police, he goes off to jail. You're under authority, and that's what God expects you to do. Okay, so far on that one. We may come back with that one, but let's take, you have two Christians. Is there anybody that disagrees? Of course, all of you disagree. Okay, you have two Christians. And let's say similar type of scenario, except both of them are really dedicated Christians, but the husband really has a problem losing his temper. But he recognizes that he's wrong. And I don't mean in the syndrome where they go through this cycle and do it, but he actually has a problem, and he wants help with the problem. Or we can turn it around. The wife loses her temper and claws his eyes out every time she gets a chance. Same, but she just does it when she gets mad. What can you do? Both of them are Christians. Well, that's where they come to the church, and they say, we have this problem. And what you say to them is, whenever it starts to get a problem, you call us. And right now, before you get upset with each other, we need you to invest in our team the authority to handle the situation as we see fit under those circumstances. And if they say, yes, we want to do that, then you do it. They say, no, I'm not quite sure I want to give anybody authority to do that. Can't help you. That answer it? Okay. You want to add to that question?
Yeah.
Go right ahead.
Does it ever give you, do gifts ever give you the right as a person to step out from under authority? Maybe that's the same question.
No. You never have the right to. Once a person, regardless of their gift, steps out from underneath authority, they're out of God's will, period. And God would prefer that we be hurt or suffer. He would prefer that to happen than for us to step out from underneath authority. It's exactly what Moses did. 40 years old, he goes out and sees this guy beating on his servant, so he kills him. He stepped out from underneath authority. What was the consequences that Moses had to pay? 40 years in prison, Moses had to pay for his crime in killing his fellow man. Isn't that what it was? Didn't he spend 40 years in the wilderness? How would you like to spend 40 years in the wilderness? I mean, the wilderness there is a real, real wilderness. Just every bit is worse than any prison you could dream up here. That's why people don't like to go to jail in Saudi Arabia or Iran, because those jails are terrible. God, he paid a price for the person he took, the life he took, because he did not have the authority to do it. Well, how about these 250 people that were rebelling against Moses, and the earth opened up at Moses' bidding, and it swallowed him? Well, he killed 250 at one whack on that one. He was under God's authority. All the difference in the world. The motivational gift does not ever give us the right to step out from underneath God's authority. But it is wise, big W, it is wise if you get permission from an authority figure to operate to start with. And you tell them it's irrevocable. The only way you can revoke this is leave and not come back. Because if you come back, you're still under the authority, because I'm telling you up front that it's irrevocable. And why do you do that? Because if you don't, you're going to find yourself in a trap. They're going to jerk the authority back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. No, we're not going to play that game. If you want me here, if you want me to invest myself emotionally or spiritually, or whatever, then it's going to cost you something. And what it's going to cost you is, I want a piece of your authority so I can deal with the situation. If I tell you to jump hoops here in front of your family, I expect you to do that. Why? Because you've given me the authority to tell you what to do to cause some changes to take place. And you better believe I give some very, very rough assignments when I'm in counseling. You say, example of that, they bring in a 15-year-old kid who stands up in their face and spits on them and says, I'm not going to do the thing you tell me. And they're all three sitting there, and I said, you think not? I turn to the parents. What I want you to do as soon as you get home is I want you to strip that kid's bedroom. I want you to take everything out of it. I want you to take everything out of the drawers, dump them in the floor, move the bed and everything else out into the garage. The kid doesn't get any of it back until he says he gets it back. Why do I have the authority to do that? Because remember, you said when you walked in, you gave me the authority, and I expect you to go do it. But the other thing that happens is, I agree with them, if you got problems with your teenager, the three of us are going to agree about what we're going to do about this problem. And I expect you to support me, and I'm going to support you. And if you don't support me, I'm going to jump on you with both feet and two arms. If you don't support your mate, I'm going to jump on you for not doing that. The thing this child needs to learn is that all three of us are in concert and are dealing with this problem, and the kid is going to straighten up or else. And they're going to think the world's really rough, or they're going to find that they're not getting by with anything. They may have been able to slide past with their parents, but I'm as hard as a rock. I guess you've gathered that by now. You didn't get that during the first two sessions, did you? You know, you thought, he's a real passive counselor. I'd like to go to him. No, I'm not sure I want to go to him now. But if that's how you're dealing with problems, then the reputation that you get, your teams get, is they walk in a home and they know, the people know, something's going to happen. And they know that when you leave, that you have helped solve the problem, that you're going to be back, and on a long-term basis, you're going to be working with a family, and you're not charging them something, you're not demanding something of them, but one day, because of what you've done with their family, for their family, they're going to be sitting back there in the pew, and then they're going to be migrating down to the front seat, and they're going to be saying, I'd like to be on one of your alert teams. I've experienced it firsthand. I got some things that I can help these people with. I really appreciate the opportunity. And so you get people out of the pews doing something. I mean, they come to God's house to worship, and then they go out in the world, and that's where you convert people. You don't convert people here, you convert them out there. And they do it by example, but most of all, I guess I'm getting carried away, but most of all, you do it by example, and you're able to show those people God's power and how strong He is. Your alert team, before you get to that house, you're praying and saying, God, we ask you for the power and the strength to deal with what's going on there. And Lord, we expect that you will give us what we need in that house to convince these people just how powerful you are. And Lord, just in case any of them are into some of this voodooism or some of this other isms, some of this other idolatry, Lord, we ask you to show it to us that we immediately see it, and so that we can have a contest with their God and show them just how weak their God is in comparison to our God. And the first fight you have with them is going to be over who's the most powerful God. Yeah, I think I will give you an example of that. But you need to... How much time do I have? You need to understand, it is not me. It is not me. It's when you do God's will, God is going to defend you. You don't defend yourself. You don't justify yourself. You don't explain or any of that. I'm not saying, you really need to understand, I am not saying it has anything to do with me. But whenever you walk with God, whenever you depend on God for the things that you have, it's just like it was with Moses. One day, his own sister came to him and said, they want a rebellion. I want to be in your place, Moses. Moses didn't get mad or upset. He said, God, you do whatever you wanted to. God told Moses, you get out of the way. I'm going to deal with her. Moses didn't deal with her. God deals with her. Your enemies, you don't deal with. God deals with them. And I promise you, He will deal with them. And the more you see that happening, the more dependent you become on Him. And it's a real surprise to me. I don't know what life would be like if I couldn't depend on God. I remember one night I was with my partner and I had gone by this corner, and there was these two guys out there going right at it. One had a knife, and the other, I don't know what the other guy had. And I jumped out of the car and told my partner to go around to the other side. I'll get him. Well, the guy took off down across this parking lot down into this real narrow apartment complex. You've seen them before. Dark as sin. Dark as it can be. And here I'm chasing him. As soon as I hit that first stair leading down that hallway, I heard that voice inside. Stop. I'm used to listening to God. I stopped. And he prompted me any way you want to put it. He said, he's waiting around that next bend by that staircase, and he wants to kill you. I said, okay, Lord, what do you want me to do? Go back to the car? He said, no. Take your weapon out. Turn your flashlight off. Okay, Lord, I'll do that. Walk softly. So I walked softly. And then he said, stop. So I stopped. God didn't even know I was there. It was so quiet. Usually I'm real, make a lot of noise. Walking as softly as I could, he said, stop. I stopped. He said, turn to your left. I turned to my left. Turn your flashlight on. There's this nut brain, I'm sorry, there's this guy standing there with this huge hammer who's ready to hit me over the head. And now he, instead of him being able to do that, he's facing a flashlight and a gun. Well, obviously the Lord took care of that situation. But I'm wanting you to see that you can depend on the Lord, good or bad. God uses suffering, God uses pain, God uses these things in our lives, and we don't need to resist or rebel about those things. So we're sick and so we're suffering. Why get in a hurry about getting healed or getting well? I mean, I've had diabetes for 15 years. And it's surprising, as horrible as it can be, the Lord has taught me many things by being diabetic. It's even gotten to the point I wouldn't even ask Him to heal me. Unless some of those nights when you're really hurting, you may want to, but it's, there's just so many character things or qualities that He has taught me from those situations. Some of the most powerful things, I mean, you know, when I get depressed or upset or whatever, the Lord just has His ways of encouraging me. Obviously, I depend on the Lord for encouragement instead of people. Tomorrow, I'll tell you why, but I depend on the Lord for the encouragement instead of people. And the Lord just has some unique ways of doing that. And so when we come back to the next session, which will probably be the last session, by the way, because I don't want to lose my voice and not be able to talk tomorrow, because the Lord has some things He wants to tell you that has nothing to do with the motivational guest tomorrow, unless He changes my mind. We will talk about, when we come back for the last hour, we'll start off by telling you what happened. Thank you.